Welcome to another episode of the Growth Focus podcast, where we bring together tech leaders from all across the globe to share their time, their insights, and their expertise to help us all grow in our business. My name is Gary Lafty, the founder and creator of Authority Accelerators, where we drive revenue and profits by elevating tech leaders from just a mere expert in their field to being the authority where their clients choose them, as opposed to them having to do all the running around and chasing. And this episode, I'm extremely pleased to have Ted Harrington with us. And we're going to be talking things about standing out in a crowded market, growing a business, especially something like security, but even more interesting, ethical hacking. So if you want to find out what that means and how that could benefit, make sure you stick around for the whole episode. So without further ado, Ted, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here on the episode. Thank you very much for joining us. Why don't you start off by briefly introducing yourself and what is it that you do?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to be here and help however I can. So I run with a business partner, a company called ISE, which stands for Independent Security Evaluators, and we're in the business of ethical hacking. And what that is, if people aren't familiar with it, is it's good guys who help by doing bad guy stuff. So we use all the same tools and techniques and approaches and methods as the bad kinds of hackers do. You know, organizations you hear about in headline news talking about how they attacked companies or governments or schools or whatever. We use all those same tools and techniques, but our motivation is not to exploit an organization. It's to help it build better, more secure systems.
That's amazing. This is why I can't wait to dive a little bit further into this, because more people, more often than not, there'll be people listening here who are involved in the security side, the cybersecurity side of their business. And their main role, as we always is to find out where the holes are and protect against the hackers. Yet you're coming through from a different angle and growing ISE into doing this ethical hacking. What was the pivotal moment? What made you think of doing it this way around as opposed to the traditional route?
Traditional route being a bad hacker?
Yeah. We're just trying to just stop everybody, as opposed to being a hacking side of it. Yeah. Just find out where the holes are and just plug in them.
Yeah. So it's a good question. And I think the best way to answer that would be to tell a story about my business partner, Steve. He founded the original version of the company. We're sort of in the second iteration of it. We call it 2.0 internally right now. And it was really just born out of a piece of security research. You know, all the way back in 2005, there was this Steve and a couple of his colleagues in the PhD program at Johns Hopkins, they were looking at doing some security research. There was this really widely utilized system that's used in the anti-theft mechanism for cars. It's called the immobilizer system. And basically what it does is it makes sure that you have to have the authentic key in order to start the car. And if you don't, the computer on board in the vehicle will immobilize the vehicle. And that system at the time was considered to be, I mean, literally it was stated that it was unhackable. It was like, this cannot be defeated. The problem with that is, you know, you say that to a bunch of hacker-minded, you know, computer scientists, and they're going to say challenge accepted. And so that's what they set out to do, was to explore this particular system. And sure enough, you know, took a few weeks to reverse engineer the cryptographic algorithm, a few weeks to build a prototype of a weaponized software radio. And then a few weeks later, there they were starting a Ford Escape without the authentic key, proving that in fact this system could be defeated. And that was really the launch moment, because then once that research was published, it was picked up by media outlets all over the world, and really companies came calling and they were saying, hey, look, you understand how the bad guys think, you understand how to break systems, we're building something, can you help us understand how it might be attacked? And that, even today, you know, we're in our 20th anniversary this year of the company. And that today is still the underlying ethos of the business, is how can we look at a system that's supposed to do X? Can it in fact do Y instead? And how do we eliminate that problem?
Yeah. So it's a really good case for when everyone is zigging, you're doing the zagging. You're doing what no one else is going to do, just to stand out more to grow the company from there. So we're talking about growing of a company. Cybersecurity, very, very populated area within the industry. What is it that you've been doing to stand out above all the noise that's actually out there, to get more clients, to get more deals, to get more prospects to talk to you?
Yeah. Noise is the exact right word that you just used. There is this problem that exists in our corner of our field, which I imagine probably persists in many fields as well, but it's especially notable here where you have this problem that because there's such rampant desire to buy services like ours, that's one factor. A second factor is that you've got the people who buy those services generally don't necessarily always understand how this type of service works. And that's not a knock against the people who buy these services. That's why they're buying the service. They're like, I need an expert who can do this thing. I'm trained in this other area. Let's bring in the expert. So there's those are the first two factors. And the third factor is that you've got a lot of security companies that are willing to sell something that isn't what is being presented. And that sounds extreme, but it is in fact what's happening. So a perfect example is there is a type of service that is called penetration testing. And penetration testing means a particular specific type of service. It's a service that a lot of organizations are looking to buy because they're required to for regulatory reasons or whatever. And yet there are companies out there who sell this term. They're calling it penetration testing, and it's something completely different, something completely and wildly different. And the sort of the metaphor I often use is that it's like you go to a doctor and one doctor says like, oh, you've got this ailing knee, you need a knee replacement. And they mean literally they're going to replace your knee joint. And then you're like, I'm gonna get a second opinion. You go to the next doctor and they're like, oh yeah, you need a knee replacement. And they're like, I'm gonna give you a Band-Aid and an IV, but we're gonna call it a knee replacement. And they're calling it the same thing, but it's wildly different delivery of what you're gonna get. And then put yourself in the shoes of that patient. You don't know the difference. You're like, okay, this is the expert, they're trained. So the way that we stand out in that really confusing marketplace is through education. So appearing on podcasts like yours, I mean, we're going to talk about the business side more so than like the actual differentiating elements of what you need to do to secure something. But that's why I write books and I appear on podcasts and I deliver keynotes and things like that, is because we really need to educate the marketplace on what things are and what they are not. And we're not going to be able to successfully educate everybody. But by being that organization who can really help clarify a confusing scenario, that does help us both attract clients, as well as when the clients already know that they maybe want to work with us. And they're like, you know, ISE, they write the book on this, and they're comparing to someone else who maybe doesn't. And that's not disparaging to any of the competition out there, but like that is a notable difference. And so for us, not only do we get to help solve a problem through education, but indirectly then it helps our business.
Yeah, no, I totally understand that. And I'm so glad you said that, because, you know, those who've listened to our show before know that Authority Accelerators uses the 5P principles, and you're already using 3 of those to build your authority, which is podcasting, presenting on keynotes, and publishing the book. So it's great to see that someone's actually walking that talk there and doing this educational-based marketing, because buyers generally don't know what they don't know. And then when they do are ready to try and buy something, they've then got to do their research. But by you being out there in the forefront first, doing that education, you're, again, at top of mind as and when they are ready to buy from that. So what was you talked about educational-based marketing and appearing on podcasts and whatnot. Let's talk about your book, yeah, Hackable, how to do application security right. And you also did a TED Talk. And so how are these two things helping you demonstrate yourself as an authority within this industry?
Well, first of all, I wanted to do those things because they were hard. And that is, I, like many people in the hacking profession, are driven by a challenge. And so writing a book is hard. And a lot of people want to write a book. And even people who start books, most of them don't finish. So to actually publish a book, to me, I was like, that's worthy. And then not only is it hard, then you get to do something. You solve a real problem for a real audience. And like part of what motivated me to want to write Hackable was I noticed this really interesting confluence of factors. The first was that because of what we do, whether it's we're talking to customers or after a keynote, I talk to people all the time about what their security challenges are. What are you struggling with? Why are you struggling with that? What's the barrier in your way? All that kind of stuff. And over time, I realized that pretty much everyone has the same problems. Now, that's irrespective of how large the company is, how mature it is, what industry sector it's in, what geographic location it's in. Everyone kind of has these same common problems. They might not necessarily all know them by the same terms, but through observation, I was able to say like, this is that bucket, this is that bucket. And I thought that was really interesting once I realized most people who are trying to build some sort of software solution, they struggle with how to secure it. And those struggles, everyone kind of has all the same problems. I thought that was interesting. So then I I said, well, what are the common solutions? How do you solve those? And that was the moment when I was like, I have to write this book, because I realized that the common solutions, the way that most people talk about solving those problems that everyone has, were wrong. Like, people were actually talking about security backwards in terms of how you solve these problems everyone has. I'm like, that's crazy. So I have to go solve that because I know the answers to those. And so that ultimately was the structure of the book, was for this audience who's, you know, building things and has to build them more securely or has to prove it to their customer or whatever. How do I help them solve that problem? And that was the basis for writing the book. So I think I went down a train of thought, and I forget what the exact question was, but that was the motivation for why I wrote the book.
No, I'm telling you, as a fellow author, congratulations, because it is hard. It took me 12 years to actually get down to, from the idea of writing a book to actually getting the first words down, and then obviously getting it published and whatnot. So, you know, I do appreciate what you say. It is hard. It's a hard thing to do. But I'm also of the philosophy that I'd rather be the person known to have written the book rather than the person reading the book. Because if you can be at, if you want to jumpstart and be at the top of your industry, then, but then publishing is one of the very, very best ways of doing it. So with that being said, one thing that I want to dial a little bit back on from what you just said is that most people are doing it wrong. You know, when it comes down to doing security, and therefore, again, we're going to that zig and a zag. When everyone's zigging, you're taking the zag route from doing that. How have you found the audiences out there accepting the fact that, or even opening, or are they open to it, or are they closed to it, the fact that someone else is talking and almost turning the industry on its head? Because this is not what we normally know. This guy is saying it should be done this way. How are the audience accepting this?
Yeah, I would say that one of the most rewarding feelings that I can have, and there are many that I'd put in the bucket of rewarding feelings, but definitely one of them that's right near the top of the list, is when I can be talking with someone, especially someone who's been doing what they've been doing for a really long time. They're absolutely an expert at it. And I can share with them this new paradigm. And they say, wow, I never thought of it that way. And if you can get someone to think about something differently, these amazing things happen for that person. And that to me is really, really powerful and rewarding, to create a new opportunity, a new reality, new pathways for another person just by helping them think differently. I mean, that right there is the hacker ethos. I'm working on my second book right now. It's called Inner Hacker. And it's about how you can take the hacker mindset and apply it to anything, to starting a company or getting promoted or even launching a charity, like whatever you're trying to do, the hacker mindset will help you do it. And the key to it is the ability to think about something differently. Now, not everyone, in fact, I would say most people are resistant to thinking differently. And so in a sense, that is the challenge of it, is most people's innate wiring is going to be to say to any sort of advice that's like, hey, I know that we've this whole time been thinking that up is up, but what if up is down? That to a lot of people is like, whoa, hold on a second. No, no, no. I've been conditioned my whole life. I'm thinking in this exact way. And I don't like that. That makes me uncomfortable, which makes sense. We come as humans, we're tribal by nature. We want to be in the tribe, we want to be in the community. And the hacker mindset requires you to deviate from the way the tribe thinks. But when you do that, and when you can have that really powerful and beautiful moment I mentioned earlier, where someone can say, wow, I never thought of it that way, it's like there's this whole pasture with completely untrampled grass that you can now go blaze new trails through. Like, why walk down this path that's completely trodden down? Everyone walks down this path and you don't even realize that you're in the middle of this green field, and trying to get people to realize, hey, it might be faster if you just cut across the field, just go over there, you know, trample your own grass. And that is really powerful. So I would say that it's the minority of people who are willing to have their mind open to change their mind. Yeah. But that is why it's worth doing, because when you can help people change their mind and see differently, amazing things happen as a result for that person.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Ted. I think you're absolutely right. When we can change people's mindsets, make people think of a different way, make them think, oh, I never thought of it that way. Oh, that's got me thinking. Yeah. It does. And I love the analogy. You know, why go into this downtrodden path where everyone's going, well, the whole crowd's going, when, like you say, that green grass, that field is open to you because you're the one that's opened the mind. You're the one that can take them further on that. And what a great, great analogy to use on that. So that being said, tech people in general, and I can already hear some of the people listening to this are going, oh, I couldn't do that. That's just not the way it's done, you know, and let alone writing a book and then going out and presenting it and whatnot. They're not known for stepping into the spotlight, tech people. What advice can you give founders out there who, unfortunately, on one extreme, they have this, what I call the field of dreams mentality, where it's so great, if I build it, they'll come, and therefore end up being the world's best secret. And those who are a little bit braver and say, yeah, I'll do it, but they end up doing more teaching than they do inspiring. Now, and as you were, when you got to do a podcast or you want to write a book, you want to change people's perspectives on that. What advice could you share or insights could you share with some the founders listening today going, that's not a bad idea. I wonder what the first step would be.
That's a real challenge for sure. We're talking about tech people, we're talking about founders, but this is probably true for most humans, right? Where it's scary to go do this. It's scary to put ourselves out there. It's scary to, like a lot of people, especially really smart people, are scared of, they suffer from imposter syndrome. Imposter syndrome is this idea where it's like, well, I'm not the qualified person to state this. And I felt that for writing my book. I was like, yeah, I mean, we have all this experience. We've published all this research. We've done all this stuff. But like, am I really the person who can write this book? And what we have to do is we have to acknowledge fear. We have to realize that it's fear that's preventing us from doing these things, not any other limitation. And that fear exists in our head. And there's an exercise that we can do. I'm actually writing about this in Inner Hacker, about a fear handling exercise that I learned through the process of writing my first book. And in a very simplified way, essentially what you'd need to do is, first you need to state what the fear is. Like in the case of writing Hackable, my fear was, I was afraid of writing a bad book. I was like, man, wouldn't that be a bummer if I spend all that time and effort and I get to the end of it and it's a bad book? So that was a real fear that I had. I might write a bad book. And then you think about, because that's the first step, you identify the fear. The second step is you identify what is the bad thing that happens if that fear comes to be true. And that's really powerful, because most of the time you realize like, it's not actually that bad. In this case, it would have been like, I would have wasted time and money and effort and maybe most likely eroded my credibility. So that last one is probably the most significant. And then you think about the third question is, what is the likelihood that thing happens? And you can say high, medium, or low, or you can assign a numerical value, whatever. But you sort of think about it and you realize like, okay, well, without any other change, the likelihood of that happening is maybe like medium to low is what I figured. Like, I'm probably gonna, there's so many bad books out there. Like, even without trying, I'll probably have at least like a like mediocre book, you know? But then it leads to the most important question, which is, what can you do to mitigate the likelihood of that outcome? And that was like, it was so crystal clear. If I use the same example, where I was like, write a good book. If I write a good book, it completely neutralizes the fear of writing a bad book. And that is actionable, because now I can ask questions like, what makes a book good? And those are really clearly defined questions. Like, you have to know your audience. You have to know what their problem is. You have to give them a solution to their problem. You have to not sell to them. You have to give them something they can take action on. You have to make it simple to understand. And it's like, once you have these like 5 or 10 guiding principles, I could now go do that. Now, I'll leave it to the reader of the book to determine whether it's a good book or not. But at least I can say confidently, I did not write a bad book. And so that's, I think, the advice that I would give to anyone listening to this, who, whether it's, doesn't have to be writing a book, doesn't even have to be giving keynotes. It could just be like putting yourself out there in some way, because people want to hear from founders. Like, founder-led marketing is so profoundly powerful. It's why even today, Mark Zuckerberg is still advertising for Facebook. You know, everyone knows who he is. Everyone knows what Facebook is. Because founder-led marketing is really effective and people should be doing that. People want to know what the founder believes. And in order to do that, you need to overcome fear, because fear is the only thing that's holding you back.
Yeah, that's a really, really important insight. You know, Ted, you're breaking that down for us. Thank you very much. Because yeah, it's always the fear of the unknown, and the unknown feeds in the brain. Yep. You know, it's not that when you're doing public speaking, when you have to get up there and you start thinking, oh, what happens if I just make myself look a fool and whatnot? And you know, and then we have to go through these fear exercises and fear bashing exercises all the time. So yeah, you know, thank you very much for breaking that down, because there are people out there who want to do and stand up and talk and write a book and be known and share their founder-led story. And it's ironically, we've been talking a lot on this channel about founder-led sales is very popular. It doesn't matter if you're at 10, 15, 20 million, there's still an element of founder-led sales. Yet founder-led marketing gets kicked to the side at a very early stage of growing a business and almost thrown into a marketing department because they don't want to do it. Yet it's fantastic to hear you turn around and go, no, it is so important to build that brand out there, build that person they want to know about you and whatnot. So let's turn the corner a little bit in that, Ed. Building a business is great, but we all know that it's not a straight line. It's a big spaghetti part of when it comes to growing a business. There are things that work tremendously well, then there are things that don't generally work. So what have been some of the highlighted challenges you've had in growing your business, especially in this competitive field?
I like this question because even as we were preparing for this podcast and you're describing the premise of it and you're like, we want you to help other founders grow their business. And I was like, I don't know if I'm qualified to discuss this because I'm still, you know, slogging through fighting the fight too. And I think that's the entrepreneur's journey is that, you know, you have one win and then you have 99 losses punching you in the face over and over and over again until you get that next win. And that one win is what helps keep charging you through. Was the question about what things have worked or what things have not worked? Because one is a shorter conversation.
Yeah, not work. Let's go for not work because, you know, in marketing 101, for argument's sake, they'll always say, do this, do this, do this. And this channel is there to bust all of those and say, this is what actually works from people who've got boots on the ground. But also what is never taught is what doesn't really work. Doesn't work in the real life out there. So the challenge, we've all had challenges in growing businesses. As I said, especially in an industry which is oversaturated with more and more people of varying degrees of qualification are coming into the industry. What challenges have you had in growing that business and what mistakes have been made that you wish to share that you wouldn't want someone else to do?
Yeah. Well, in a people-oriented business like us, one of the primary constraints is, of course, how do you scale talent? So at ISC, it's a service providing business. We're consultants. And how do you scale that? And I think that's been a constant throttle for a company like ours. And I imagine anyone else who has a professional service company or an aspect to their company that has professional services, that's really, really difficult to grow. And I think that we've tried every possible scenario you could to how do you scale the human element. But I can tell you from something that we identified very early on that we just knew for a fact in a business like the ours to grow doesn't work and does work is what doesn't work is selling something. And it's really interesting because there's so much advice out there about like, here's how to sell. Here's what the script is. Here's how to like make a value proposition. And I've never believed in that. I think what works is solving a problem for an audience. And that probably is trite. Like, of course it is, like marketing or sales 101. But how often is almost everything that we do, like think of anyone you've ever interacted with, someone who's contacted you about anything, they're selling you shit. They're selling you stuff. Maybe we have to bleep that out. They're not necessarily trying to solve your problem. And I think a perfect example of that was like very, very early on in our company, we secured a meeting with a very, very large tech company, like the kind of tech company that's the dream customer and is impossible to get a meeting with. And we went into it with this inclination that like we're here to solve a problem, not to sell something. So we chose not to bring a pitch deck. And it was really interesting when we sit down, there's two of us, just me and my business partner, Steve, we just went together. And then I think there were like 15 of them, maybe 20. And first thing, there's no pleasantries. There was no like, oh, how's the weather? It was just like, all right, give us the pitch. And that was a really terrifying moment because we're like, well, we didn't bring one. Why did you want to meet with us? Like, there's 15 of you in here. There's some burning problem that you're wanting to solve. You asked some security consultants to spend an hour with you or whatever. Like, what do you want to talk about? And it was this kind of like, you could hear a pin drop moment because everyone's like, this is different. And we didn't know how it was going to go. And then the person who's in charge, the VP or whatever, kind of looked around. He's like, well, there's this. And he's presented an issue. And we just started talking about that. And it turned, you know, I think we had 45 minutes earmarked and it turned into like 2 hours we were there. And when we're leaving, they said to us, they were like, this is the best presentation we've ever heard. Thank you for that. And so I'm not directly answering your question, because it's not like we failed by, you know, there wasn't a lesson that we learned from to take to the next one with this, but we listened to our instinct. I think a lot of people ignore their instinct and say, well, the data says everyone shows a pitch deck. We should bring a pitch deck. This is a major company. We should do it the safe way. They're expecting a pitch. Give them a pitch. And we chose not to do that, which we, like, if we'd failed that meeting, we never would have gotten back in with them. But as a result, we wound up getting a whole bunch of contracts with them. And so it was a really, really cool moment to do something a little different. But it started from the viewpoint of, like, what does the person on the other side table want? What do they need from us? And even though they said, show me the pitch, they did not need to hear the pitch. They needed to hear their problems solved.
And I think that's a very valuable point. And, you know, we've mentioned this several times before that, again, because this is a tech podcast, a podcast for tech, there's almost like this, what we call product or service led first, as opposed to outcome led first. And by going in, finding exactly what their problems are, what is the outcome they want? Then the problem is stopping them getting the outcome. Then find out what the problem is, and then you can have a product or service that deals with that that problem. And it is a case of reverse engineering it, but when it, especially in this industry, we tend to build it first and then go, oh, this is what we got, cookie cutter. Mm-hmm. This is what you need. But we're just not really, really delving into exactly what they want. And, you know, for those people who are listening out here and thinking, how did he go in there without a pitch deck? This is the thing. Go in there, be very, very secure in what you know, knowing that you can actually help them achieve the outcome they want, and just find out what that outcome is, as opposed to pushing your agenda. Great piece of advice there, Ted, from that. So what piece of advice? There'd be people out there today, they'd be listening into it, go, this makes a lot of sense. And so I've got this sort of last loaded question for you, Ted, really. It's like, you know, you're the zigger when everyone is zagging. You're the guy that turns things on upside down. You're almost like the tree shaker, just to see what falls out and then put it back together again the way you want it to done. If you could give yourself, your younger self, Ted, one piece of advice regarding the success of growing a tech company, knowing what you know now, what would that piece of advice be?
Just be patient, I guess. That's a lesson you have to learn over time. I think a lot of entrepreneurs are impatient, and that's a good thing. That is actually, I would not say we should dial that down. But when I look at what it's taken for us to establish prominence in a selected market and really cement that and then expand that, it's always felt like it's taken 10 times longer than we would have liked it to. And then when you look at that, you realize, like, look at the way I even phrased it, right? 10 times longer than we would have liked it to. Not 10 times longer than it's supposed to, like, it takes the duration it's supposed to take. And I think that that is something I just had to learn, but, you know, that's advice that maybe giving myself, just keep going. Like, you're doing the right thing. Just be patient. You know, don't pivot too soon. A lot of people want to say, like, yes, you want to find product market fit immediately. You want to do that really fast, but I see a lot of founders maybe pivot too quickly, because, like, they don't immediately get the thing solved. But that, it's not because they're pivoting too quickly or not quickly enough. It's because maybe they're coming at it from the wrong way around. The right way around would be, who's the audience? What's the problem they're trying to solve? And let's go solve that problem.
Yeah, fantastic, fantastic. Well, if people want to get hold of you, they want to learn more about you, Ted, what's the best way of getting hold of you?
Best would just be to go to tedharrington.com. That's my name. That's where you find information on our ethical hacking business, on what I do as a keynote speaker, about my books, whatever. Everything is there, including where to find me on social media. Just go to tedharrington.com.
Brilliant. Well, I'll make sure that that link is in the show notes for us, so people can jump on it straight away. Well, Ted, thank you very much. I mean, time just flies so quickly, especially when we've got great guests. So, yeah, thank you very much for your time and sharing your insights with us today. It's been an absolute honor.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, most welcome. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for yet another episode of the Growth Focus Podcast. And as per usual, if you've learned anything or taken anything away today, please make sure you comment below so that other people can see what you've learned and perhaps they can take it. But more importantly, please make sure you share. This is how we all grow, by taking these bits of nuggets, these insights from tech leaders from across the globe, and then taking action on them. Remember, knowledge is not power. It's only when you take action on that knowledge that you actually see the benefits of it. So until next time, keep striving, keep profitable, and we'll see you on the next episode. Bye-bye.